Hi there, and welcome to episode 2 of Hogfish Resonance. In this episode, I'll be speaking with Laura Careless, a Brighton, England-based dance artist. Laura was one of the artists in residence during Hogfish's first summer residency back in 2022, during which time she choreographed and performed in the end-of-season opera, The Magic Tree. Laura is a graduate of the Royal Ballet School in London, the École Atelier of Maurice Béjart in Lausanne, Switzerland, pardon my horrible French, and the Juilliard School Dance Division in New York City, where she received the John Erskine Prize for Artistic and Academic Excellence. Upon graduation from Juilliard, Laura became a founding member and principal performer at Company 14, a Brooklyn-based multimedia production company. She has also worked as a guest artist with the Metropolitan Opera. A few months after performing in Hogfish's The Magic Tree, Laura returned to Maine, bringing with her her spectacular multimedia dance performance entitled She-Wolves. She-Wolves is adapted from a book by the historian Helen Castor, and it tells the stories of six royal women who ruled England before Elizabeth I. Through dance, theater, song, and some very cool animated projections, Laura explores Britain's historical relationship with gender and power and seeks to reclaim She-Wolf as a symbol of personal rewilding. Here are a couple quick excerpts from the show just to give you a little taste of it.
In the medieval world, power was inescapably male. Yet despite everything that stood in their way, a handful of extraordinary women did attempt to rule. When they pursued power like kings, these royal women were vilified as she-wolves.
These are the stories of the she-wolves of England. A healthy woman is much like a wolf. But when we are separated from this instinctive nature, the symptoms may include feeling exceedingly dry, fatigued, depressed, confused, gagged, muzzled, unaroused.
I'm so pleased to be able to share our conversation with you. Laura and I discuss the importance of bringing the entirety of our passions and interests to the art-making process, the value of giving voice to the voiceless, and the connection that she sees between rewilding and regeneration, and so much more. I hope you enjoy it. This is Hogfish Resonance. Amazing. Oh, cool. Well, I would love his take on the podcast when it starts coming out. And all of you, I hope you'll consider yourselves to be contributors. And I'd love your feedback on how I'm putting this together.
Your background is in anthropology. Is that right?
Right.
I think it's such a wonderful perspective to have on art making, because as you may have encountered, artists tend to make and work in bubbles, and it doesn't do us any favors. So I'm really excited that you're working with Hogfish in this way.
I am thrilled. This is my sweet spot. My first dream was actually theater, and I ended up going to NYU Tisch and hated it and decided to go on to journalism, and then it ended up anthropology. And now I feel like I can marry all the loves that I've had in my life into one beautiful project of finding out what it is that performance does for us.
It's a pretty sweet spot for me too. And I think it's something that our culture often doesn't afford us until we get a bit older. We can stop thinking of our working lives in terms of a career or a field and actually start thinking about what we might have to offer, or what our interests are, what our biography is, and how it all fits together to be of service. And one thing that I learned from doing She-Wolves is how much I love history. And I didn't, it was something that was just kind of simmering in the background until I started making it. And it's an unusual combination, perhaps, I'm realizing, to perform and to have that passion for history within one's storytelling.
And I think it's such a wonderful lesson, because what you did was so beautiful and so unique and so powerful that I think sometimes we forget, as just as human beings, that all the things that move us and get us out of bed every day, if you combine them, what a powerful thing. First of all, it makes it really fun, but sometimes these hidden interests that we think of maybe as hobbies or something like that inform the creations that we do, and suddenly we're doing something unique and different and something that's wholly our own. We're not trying to copy anybody else.
Right. And I feel that that connects deeply in with the idea of regenerative art making. Now, I think certainly through my training, through conservatory, was very much about taking parts of me away from my art making, conforming to ideals. And this idea that our whole selves can be involved in our creativity, that creativity isn't a skill just to be brought out, you know, in one class at school, or in one hobby when you're an adult, or when you're making dinner at night. It's a power that we have within us for everything. And it excites me to think about what we might be capable of when we approach any part of our lives with our whole being.
Absolutely. And I love that you made the connection with regenerative performance or regenerative arts, because one of the main things that I feel like when people are saying, what is, you know, what are regenerative arts, what does that mean? And when we're thinking about its connection to regenerative agriculture, for me, one of the big things is they're both really tied into systems thinking, and how does one thing impact the other? So as you were saying, it's not about compartmentalizing our creativity from some other aspect of our life. It's how do all these things inform us?
Yes.
And on that note, let's talk about She-Wolves. I saw it both nights that it played in Portland, and I was just so blown away by it, really. You know, both the execution of it and the originality of the idea. What inspired you to create this multimedia experience based on the lives of these six British monarchs?
She-Wolves is based on a book by the historian Helen Coster. And the way I received this book is quite magical. My birthday is in November, and the November of the Trump-Clinton election, I was sort of in process with a lot of different things. My husband and I had recently moved away from New York City. I'd left the company where I'd been working for over a decade. And I was beginning this process of trying to recapture my own creative voice. I'm feeling pretty lost. And my birthday was about 2 weeks after this election. And we wanted to spend some time with friends in New York City. So we hired an area in a hotel and invited friends to come. It was a really cold night. It was right after the election, and a lot of people just didn't make it. It was a sad birthday. And just as we were leaving to get back on the train upstate, a friend of mine, my dearest, oldest friend, Caroline, who went to school with me, sent me a text and said, "Laura, I'm so sorry I couldn't make it. I had a situation with a student and I just couldn't get away. Can I give you your birthday present? Can you meet me at Grand Central Station?" So we were there under the Grand Central clock, and she puts this gift into my hands. I open it, and it's this book, She-Wolves. And Caroline and I had been kind of co-reading and talking about another Wolfie book, Women Who Run With the Wolves by Dr. Clarissa Pinkola Estes, which looks at traditional tales from many cultures and examines them through a Jungian psychological lens along the themes of, you know, women's rewilding. So Caroline and I had been reading Women Who Run With the Wolves kind of together and talking about it a lot. And she had made me a necklace with a wolf on it. Like it was kind of an emblem. So she put this book into my hands and it was She-Wolves. And there was a picture of a queen up there, British Elizabeth I is the picture that's on the front of this edition. And I was just captured immediately because the idea of a queen was so different to the idea that I had grown of a wolf. They seemed different to me, and yet they were there on the same page. And it just immediately sparked my curiosity, my whole, we were talking about, you know, creating with your whole being. My whole being just kind of leapt forward. And I just went home and devoured it. And within a few chapters, there was just this really strong feeling of like, this is the thing I'm going to make. And I'd choreographed some one woman work for myself. Prior to that, Edwin from Hogfish had helped me with one of the pieces, and I was growing in confidence in my ability to make and my ability to speak on stage. It was new for me. And then, yeah, I had this book in my hands, and it just became clear that this was going to be my guide through the rest of that rewilding. It was just very clear in a very short amount of time. And I emailed the author, Helen Caster, the historian who wrote it. And I wouldn't allow myself to think about what I was gonna do. She didn't allow me to
But it was nice of you to ask permission.
But she was really excited about the idea, and we met a couple of times as well to talk about ideas. And there was one thing that she said that really guided and encouraged my process. And I hadn't heard anything like this from people who study history before, which is why I think the book is so gripping. She said, "It's easy to forget that historical figures were human." Yeah. And that the decisions that they made were not foregone conclusions when they were making their choices. And that really unleashed me to trust my process to find something essential about these women. I wanted to get the historical detail accurate, and also there's not enough of it to know everything about who they were. And what I realized was there are things about performance that can tell us more about them and their lives than any number of words ever can or ever will. And that was a really fortifying realization, and I think gave me a lot of strength to keep digging into what I might have to say. And then also the imagery of a wolf and all of the rewilding I'd done with Caroline through reading Women Who Run With the Wolves, which was also given to me by a close female friend. It just felt like here was a place for everything to go.
So cool. And as you said, it's a really interesting juxtaposition, this pairing of women and wolves. That must have been some pretty powerful imagery to get to play around with and dive into so deeply in the way that you did.
Yes, yes. The image of a wolf felt really physical to me. So that was another thing that made me feel like, oh, there's something I can say about this. You know, why was it she-wolf? Like, why was that the term of vilification? that these women were given. What is it about wolves and powerful women that evokes a similar reaction in people? They've got a similar place in fairy tales and dark fairy tales. What is it they have in common? And I thought that was something I could research through my body better than any other way it could be researched.
I love that. And I keep thinking about the title of the book and of also of your performance, is that it's She-Wolves. What is that dash? I know I see the artist's work myself, which so often is, I mean, maybe not always, but I guess for me, very often the best kind of art is watching the artist act as the bridge between two contrary ideas, and kind of the way that you did. And as I hear you talking, I keep getting the image that you were dancing the hyphen. I mean, you were dancing she-wolves, but in a way you were dancing that hyphen.
Oh, Hillary, I love that. And it intersects so closely with the way I think about the show. I had to think and feel really carefully last year about whether I was going to come back to the show, whether it was just time to make something else. And something that was really playing in my mind was this question of, well, why would I tell stories about royalty? There's already so much been said about them. There's so many stories that haven't been heard, so many underrepresented voices that I could give my attention and my time to. Why do these stories? And then I just kind of came to this conclusion that from that period and that place and time, there aren't any other women's stories. They haven't been written down. We don't know them. And even the stories of these royal women, there's very little in their own voice. And so I'm very lucky to live in a place where my ancestors have lived, as far as I know, much longer ago than when these women were alive. But I can't get back to them because of that break in women's stories being told, women's experiences being valued and nurtured. And for me, these stories of these royal women, and I hope it doesn't sound presumptuous to be talking about royal women as a bridge for me personally, but they're a bridge back to a place in a time when women's stories might have been more important or might be more valued. And that hyphen between she and wolf is absolutely another one of those bridges for me. It's, you know, the she being the queen, the woman, the person, the role, and the wolf being, you know, the things that come from the inside out. Maybe the she is like the outside in and the wolf is the inside out. And I think the part of the show that is really personal for me is about where the inside out and the outside in meet.
Toward the end of She-Wolves, you dance to a Judy Garland song, I believe.
Yeah.
It was, which was such a interesting sudden leap from thinking about several hundred years ago to recent times. Can you talk about what provoked that particular choice?
The company that I worked for in New York City, the director was very fearless about blending different genres and eras. And so that was something that I worked with a lot and that feels very comfortable to me when I'm performing. When I was making She-Wolves, I actually went through a couple different songs because I know I'm almost too comfortable. with that kind of blending. And I wanted to make sure I had good reasons for using it. So the reasons are that dance choreographed by Jonathan Watkins, who was actually a friend of mine I went to ballet school with. We've known each other since we were 11 and 12. And I think he's kind of in this rewilding process himself now. That dance, for me, is where the whole show builds to. That's sort of how it feels like on the inside. I don't know if that's how it feels on the outside. But there's a couple of threads in the making of the show that tie up in that moment. There's the build that I try to create throughout the show of moving from word into movement. And so by the time we get to that dance at the end, it's the longest chunk of dance in the show. And that's very deliberately placed towards the end, because I feel that by then the audience can inhabit the character with me and have gone on this journey from the finite medium of words to the infinite embodied medium of dance. And that's sort of the trajectory of the show, which the audience doesn't need to be conscious of, but is embedded, you know, from my perspective as a maker. And then the other thread that dance, the Mary the First dance, ties up in terms of the trajectory of the show is the connection between these women who lived a long time ago, for some audiences, in an entirely different place, and our lives now. Something that Helen Caster talks about in the book is, you know, how much has changed and how much has stayed the same. And there's just a shocking amount of content in the book that feels so relevant to me. There's so many comments about what these women were doing or not doing that just feel like out of the mouths of people that I have known in my life. And so something that I wanted to push in the show is the feeling that, yes, there's history. Yes, a lot of this is distant from us, and some of it is not distant at all. Some of it is right on top of us. That was the reasoning around using something. It's not contemporary. It was recorded maybe 50 years ago. But it's I think it's still enough in the contemporary consciousness that it feels of now, or at least, you know, familiar. And I just love this. I love the song, What Now, My Love, because that question could be posed to so many different people, including oneself.
Well, I think you absolutely succeeded in your goal, because that was absolutely how I took it when I heard it. This sudden jolt from the time ago to a time maybe not quite as contemporary as we are now, but contemporary enough that in that instant, my brain went from stories that are almost like fairy tales because they happened so long ago.
Yeah.
Shooting through the thread of time to how these themes are continuing.
Mm.
One of the moments that really was powerful for me in your performance was that time. I can't remember which queen you were talking about, but you sang a song that had been written by men. And that's sort of almost the only history that we have of her, quote unquote history. Let's do air quotes around history. Because as you say, before you start singing, everything that's said here is a lie. Here's a clip from the show with you performing that song that was sung by the bards about Eleanor of Aquitaine.
In the centuries after her death, she became known as Queen of the Troubadours. These traveling singers told a very different story. Affairs invented, achievements erased, really established. Here's a song they wrote about her, first recorded in the 16th century. Every word I'm about to sing to you is a lie.
Very, very sick, just ransom, she summoned two friars of France to come to her speedily. The king pulled down his nobles all, by one, by two, by three. A marshal, I'll go shrine the queen, and thou shalt come with me.
I think I said this at the panel discussion. I think one way to think about power is who gets to tell the stories. And do people get to tell their own stories? And obviously women are only one group who are not getting to tell their own stories.
And unfortunately, when we do tell our stories, too often the reaction is very similar to the troubadour song that you sing in the show. I'm reminded of a comment I heard by another podcaster who said that when he first started his show, he was really horrified at the vicious comments made about his guests and his female guests specifically. Really outrageous stuff about their bodies, about their message, you name it. Apparently it happened so consistently that he ended up permanently disabling the comments section for his show. Which brings me to this question that is really motivating Hogfish Resonance, and which is this idea of stories and who gets to tell them and how we tell them and how we find those stories that resonate within us and can resonate with others.
I'll just take a moment to reflect. One answer I have about what regenerative arts means to me is that there's consideration given to the full creative cycle. And this, it helps me to think about cycles in nature.
Yeah.
And how there's a winter for every summer. Not that there's a Celtic festival in bulk, which for me represents the growth of things that we can't see. It's before sort of a winter festival where, you know, before like the first snowdrops come up, and you know that there's growth happening under the earth. The light is returning, but nothing has come out of the ground yet. And for me, this is a part of the creative process that gets missed because we're living in a product-based, a product-driven society.
Yeah.
The moments of growth that we can't see are really difficult to lean into. And without those moments, we don't come up with anything new. We just keep making what we made last summer again and again and again. It's like eternal summer and nothing new comes up.
Wow.
And so I think there are moments that are very uncomfortable for me. Just knowing that there are ideas brewing and either not acting on them or not making a thing out of them. And being able to have conversations like this where you can just explore without a direction. And also share without any pressure. You know? So it's a rare performance where I feel like it doesn't matter if something goes wrong today. You know, everyone there paid for a ticket, or there's a reviewer, or, you know, because dance isn't really part of our everyday lives. You know, going to a dance performance or a performance that involves dance is like, feels like an imposition. So it better be good. Lowering the pressure and allowing the creativity and the knowledge and the growing to flow I think is important for the arts to be regenerative, to foster original ideas. And I don't think just, I would imagine that's not true in just the arts. You know, I'm thinking about people who are trying to find solutions to global warming, to people who are trying to address climate change. I hope that their funding is not dependent on them finding a solution.
Right.
I hope that their funding is dependent on them trying. And that's what it takes to come up with new ideas, to see something new grow.
I'm grateful to you for saying that. I know I am someone who in that in bulk time, that darkness when things are grow, I mean, it depends, so there's so much faith involved that things are growing beneath the surface during that, I don't know, fallow's the right word, but during that dark time when we just have to sit and be quiet. I know when I'm in between projects, I can go to a, you know, not super dark, but somewhat dark place. And again, it comes back to the message of like, how am I using my time? Am I serving my mission?
The other thing that I think is important about those dark times is that maybe that's someone else's turn.
Yeah.
You know, stop trying to say something if you don't have anything to say.
Right.
Let someone else say something. I think artists feel such pressure that it is their one and only career. And what would it be if, you know, artist was one of your identities, and that, you know, it didn't threaten your identity as an artist to make the majority of your money elsewhere. Most of my money comes from teaching. And I think a lot of artists don't have that. They feel that in order to prove themselves, they have to make their entire living out of art making. And that doesn't allow for the dark times. That doesn't allow for the winters. It doesn't allow for the ideas to percolate. And also it means that, you know, that your gifts don't get used in other ways. There's so many other ways that artists can use their gifts and their skills. And I would love for trainings and education to start sharing that idea.
Absolutely. Well, thank you for that huge bit of wisdom. And I love the beautiful smackdown of stop making it about yourself. Maybe it's somebody else's turn. Or maybe it's your turn to offer something to someone else. We can get so locked into what am I making? What am I creating? And we need to be reminded to look beyond that sometimes, that it is the seeding and the sharing, and it's the time after the harvest we're feeding one another, we're feasting, we're getting through the winter together.
No one's supposed to have all the answers. No piece of earth is supposed to grow things all the time. It's not how nature works, and it's not how new things are grown. Maybe it's worth just talking a little bit about my journey with my own regeneration creatively. I think of it as a journey of rewilding. You can't undomesticate, but you can rewild. You can't go back to that state of being a baby where all potentials are possible, but you can move forwards purposefully and with hope that you can recapture or relearn or unlearn some of the lessons that are no longer serving you. Well, I started my dance training in ballet boarding school. So I went to ballet boarding school when I was 11 years old and was there until I was 16. Really with a very specific, very narrow focus. Talk about compartmentalizing. And it came from a desire within me from when I was very young. Dancing was my thing. But because of the culture I was in, dance and ballet were synonymous. It was the only option that I knew of. the only option that my family knew of. And the only place where dancing happened was at ballet, was at, you know, your local ballet studio. And then because I showed an aptitude for it, in the manner of our society, we put all of our focus in those places where children show an early, not necessarily interest, but skill. And then I went to ballet school because I wanted to. And I was there for 5 years with this very narrow, very focused training, and then continued for 6 more years after that. It's very intensive professional dance training, eventually at Juilliard, where I had a slightly more rounded dance education, but still very much, you know, in Western concert styles. And still very much with this idea that I was there in service, not of dance, but of the person in the front of the room. And so much of our training was about us sort of becoming useful tools for a genius or a master to use.
So by the person in front of the room, you mean like the director, the artistic, you know, creator? Yeah, not even necessarily the audience.
Oh, no. Yeah, absolutely. And yet you as a dancer are the interface with the audience. And so I think there's a lot of injury that can be done when dancers, performers are trained in this way and then have repeated experiences where they are the interface with the audience. They are the ones delivering these messages, but it doesn't come from them. So I got to a point in my career, which was filled with so many wonderful things as well. You know, I had an amazing time performing in my 20s and living in New York City and performing with companies and sort of executing the vision of other people. But then when I got to the end of that time and that part of my life was coming to an end, it was a very challenging process to recapture or perhaps unlearn enough of my training that I could find my own voice again. And so that's why I think of it as rewilding, because in the same way that the earth is never going to be the same after it's been cultivated, there's still opportunity for wildness to grow. And what that looked like for me as a dancer was to not do ballet for a long time. And then after I had my baby, I didn't dance for over a year. I performed up until 3 months pregnant. And then I just had these really strong messages from my body saying, no more dancing, no more dancing for now, with no knowing about whether I was going to come back to it or not. And that was the rewilding. I was kind of getting there before I got pregnant, and then once I was pregnant and had performed for 3 months pregnant, it's like, okay. And then I didn't know whether I was going to come back to dancing. I'd made She Wolves, I made a version of it, and that's what I was performing when I was 3 months pregnant. And you know, it was kind of a big question mark what the other side of it was going to look like. And then when Owen, my son, was 1 year old, that's when the pandemic hit. So I was just starting to get back into my dancing body. And then I had more time, more time away from being in front of an audience. And so, and of course, at that point, it was a huge time of like social change and disruption, you know, in our wider culture and society. It just meant that when I came back to making She Wolves 3 years later, the digging was deep.
Wow. Listening to you, the question that comes to my mind, because I think so many of us either, you know, so many of us very consciously, maybe not consciously as well, are desperate for an unlearning. And, you know, it's sort of, you know, it's why a lot of us go to therapy. It's like, help me unlearn these patterns. Mm-hmm. Was there any other steps that you took to rewild yourself?
I love that question. And it's a really meaningful reflection for me too. Coming back into dancing, once I felt the urge again, was a lot of things, and I'm trying to find words for them. The absence of it had grown painful, because for me it is a first language. Dance is something that I was doing before I was talking, intuitively, instinctively. And so being away from it, and also being away from performing and connecting with people without words, was becoming painful. And so it became necessary for me to be dancing again. It's the best way I can describe it. And I now had to find a method by which I could do that, because the methods I could remember that had been codified, that I had learned, you know, ballet techniques since I was three, were no longer palatable to me. And so here I was, you know, in an adult, in a mother's body, relearning and unlearning at the same time. And so there's a couple of things that I remember. It's a bit of a blurry time because I was parenting an infant and it was a pandemic.
Sleep deprived.
We moved across the Atlantic, a lot happened. But a couple of flashes come to me. My husband is a musician. I don't think he would mind me saying that it was a really challenging part of our relationship at the time, because he was working and he was making art and traveling and getting the acknowledgement that comes with that. And because of the pandemic, he was gone for a long time, because he had to quarantine in between concerts and couldn't come back. So I'd be single parenting for 2 months at a time without childcare. And so one of the things that we started to do to bring equilibrium back to our relationship was that he would start finding music for me that he thought I would enjoy dancing too. So after Owen was settled for the night, I would sort of give him some descriptive words about how I wanted to move, and he would find a piece of music and I would just try moving to it. And like 3 minutes was like my max for a while, because it was just a lot. That
physically, emotionally?
Not physically. My stamina was great. Parenting an infant won't do that for you. And it wasn't even emotional. It was like soulful. Like my soul stamina had to be rebuilt, wow. I think.
Yeah.
I guess I had to rebuild the idea, the feeling, the sense that dancing was a place I could trust again. And I'm specifically avoiding the word safe, because I don't think any creative space, any evolving space can be, you know, trusted to be safe, but it can be a place that you can trust all the same. And I think it was just about building some rhythm, some ritual back into my life that involved dance again. The first step was just like re-inhabiting my body with a sense of what it looked like, feeling it and imagining it, how it looked like at the same time. And the place that I started was just questions like, what would happen if I lifted my foot off the floor and I didn't point it? What would be the alternative to that? And just trying to have a playful time.
Well, I'm just curious, was the unpointing of the toe sort of an un-balleting?
Yes, absolutely. Cool. Absolutely. Because in ballet technique and in a lot of modern technique, which are the main things that I studied as a child and a teenager, every time your foot lifts off the floor, it points. And so that was a major unlearning.
Wow.
I know.
Because I'm so interested in embodied consciousness and how a simple choice of to point or not point might transform us physically in other areas besides the actual point flex moment. Have you ever experienced something where just that choice has shifted something beyond the foot itself?
That's exactly what was overwhelming about re-entering, that re-entry moment when I was saying like 3 minutes was my max to start with. It was the flood of consciousness that came from dancing without rules.
I love it.
Thank you for helping me put words to that.
Like you, I sort of was brought up, you know, I did a little bit of dance. I was never too serious about it, although I loved it. But, you know, I was sort of brought up in a social situation where dance meant ballet. And when I was 10 years old, my mother and stepfather took me and my sister to go see Martha Graham's Errand into the Maze.
Yeah, I know it well.
And so you know how un-ballet that is, both in terms of, well, I'm sure there are elements of ballet that come in, but just in terms of the, it's a very eerie, dark maybe, but in a good way, deep, symbolic, psychologically penetrating performance. Basically, a woman dancing in front of, I think, what was called the creature of fear, which was presented as a minotaur. And I remember at 10 years old, sitting there, looking at this going, oh my God, I love this. And the rest of my family was completely freaked out and made us leave. And I talked to my mother recently. She's like, yeah, that was not what we were expecting. They did not like it. But I was like, this is my happy place. And I remember not even being disturbed so much that that they made us leave before it was over. But now I knew that this existed. And in thinking about the performances throughout my life that have really kind of changed my brain, I sort of think of that maybe as moment number one. Getting back to She-Wolves, you know, as I was watching you dance that, I had a very sort of profound memory of the feeling that I had watching Errand into the Maze.
You could not have said anything that was quite a compliment to me, because Graham technique was the thing that helped me out of ballet, and what brought me to the States. And yes, it's still extremely codified, and there was unlearning from that technique too. But I was older when I started studying it, so more conscious. And actually, I think this is correct because I've heard it from a couple teachers. When Martha Graham was teaching, she didn't teach her technique to children younger than 16. Which I think is really interesting. And she didn't start dancing herself until she was in her 20s.
And I love this. You said this at the panel discussion after the show. My first language is very much of the body, and then I decide what to say based on what feels right, and then I let my brain get involved. There's so few spaces where the body leads. Is there a way to describe the feeling, the state of consciousness that you're in when you are in that space where the body is doing the thinking as opposed to the mind?
For me, it's pretty simple. It's just, where do I feel consciousness? Sometimes if I've been doing a lot of computer work and then I roll out the yoga mat and do some movement or take a break, I realize that the only part of my body I can feel is my head. And there needs to be opportunity for the rest of the body to speak. And I think that looks different for different people. When I'm teaching students, and I teach ballet, but I try to teach it, you know, led by the body instead of the head. And I talk to them a lot about my cat. Because, you know, she's domesticated, but she still, you know, she doesn't have to talk. And, you know, she'll have been sleeping in a spot of sunlight for hours at a time and then get a piece of string out and immediately her whole body launches into following it. Her whole being is involved in chasing the string without a warm-up, without a consideration, and with like complete coordination. And think something that often doesn't get talked about in the arts or in body work is desire. Desire and the pleasure of the body. And it's because I think I'm going to posit a theory here that, you know, because we associate pleasure with sex, when we talk about physical pleasure, that's just what we think we're talking about. And then because of a million social things that I'm sure you can talk to better than I can, we shut it down. This is not to, you know, belittle sexual pleasure. And also there's so many pleasures you can receive from your body. And perhaps because we've started to think about sex as something that's so narrow and specific, we've started to think about physical pleasure as something that's narrow and specific. But I think, you know, the way that I feel when I'm in the flow of performing or making or dancing is the same thing that I feel if I'm cooking a delicious meal. It's the same way that I feel when I'm, you know, laughing with my family. I don't think we need to compartmentalize the benefits of physical living into certain activities. And dancing is one way to access them, but I think there's potential for a life lived through the body that doesn't necessarily even have that much physical activity in it.
What was occurring to me about your example of the cat is that the cat is always in the moment of the string. Mm-hmm. The cat is not going, is chasing the string the best use of my time?
Is it productive? Am I being efficient? Am I exhibiting leadership skills?
Exactly. All that internal forward-thinking chatter takes us out of the moment and takes us out of our body and takes us out of our, as you said, our desire, our pleasure of the moment. Because desire is, I mean, I suppose you can desire something you don't have, but I feel true desire, and especially true desire of the body, is when you are as engulfed in the moment as you possibly can. And that can be a very hard thing to do for those of us trained to go about our lives wondering if, you know, what we're doing is the best use of our time. Speaking for myself.
And for myself, I think it's really important to say that, you know, just because I have these thoughts and ideals and experiences doesn't mean this is where I live most of the time.
Sure.
It's hard to get there in our world.
Right.
I think there's something similar about desire and creativity, I think, because they both feel like they're born of curiosity, of like being like on the edge of your experience. Like, oh, here's this thing that I know that I am, that I like, or that is interesting to me, and then what's the next thing? But that's really different than, you know, what's in my Google Calendar. It's a very different way of motivating your life. And I think, you know, I don't live in a world where I live in a world where Google Calendar is just something that I give a lot more attention to than, you know, what's the next good thing. Just so making the spaces where you can live in that consciousness for a while of like, what's the next thing that I genuinely have curiosity for. I think we have to make special spaces for that. I think being an artist here and now perhaps is about living as much of your life as you can on that edge of being in the present and then listening to your curiosity.
Amazing. Laura, thank you so much for taking the time to talk about all this. I'm really grateful for what you've created with She-Wolves, and I really urge listeners to follow you and your work and to definitely go see the show if they can.
Thank you, Hillary. Thank you for letting me take all kinds of tangents and for supporting me with your deep presence and investment in the things that are important to me. It's such a pleasure to talk with you.
Likewise. Let's do it again. Wow, so much juicy stuff in there. Thanks so much for listening. And if you would like to learn more about Laura and her work, head on over to www.shewolvesproject.com. That's www.shewolvesproject.com. And as always, if you'd like to learn more about Hogfish, its programs and offerings, go over to www.hogfish.org. In our next episode, I'll be speaking with Maria Brea, soprano. Maria is one of Venezuela's most acclaimed opera singers and has played major roles in Hogfish's 2022 and 2023 end of summer performances. Here's a clip from our talk.
I think it's nice to be approaching arts from such a modern perspective, from well-being, from building community, from respecting our environment, from respecting, well, and even more importantly, everyone's identities, how they come in their room and how they want to be appreciated, how they want to be acknowledged. I think that's so important. And if art, and particularly opera, doesn't catch up with that, it will just die because nobody can relate to that anymore, because it's not about this anymore or the diva. It's about making community.
All right. Be well, everyone. See you next time. This is Hogfish Resonance.